So what I'm going to talk about today is a study that we've already published in Science in last September. And basically this was the forensic part here, looking at the actual diseases in the colonies. And to give credit here, this was not just me and my lab, but it was a joint adventure here. So at Penn State University, I've convinced several of my colleagues to join me to begin looking at what was infecting these bees. So David Geiser, who's a mycologist, works at the molecular level, Li Wang-sui, who works on parasites, both has a historical precedence of working with parasites that infect mosquitoes, infect us, things like Leishmania, trypanosomes, and Plasmodium. Dennis Van Engelstorp has already talked about it. Over in USDARS, we had Jeff Pettis and Jay Evans on board. Judy Chen was unfortunately out of the country when most of this was being done, otherwise she would be up there. University of Arizona, we convinced Nancy Moran, as you'll hear soon from her graduate student, Vince Martinson, to join us. And then we also went and found actual germ hunters to help us out here. So as I'll talk about, we made a convincing case and got Ian Lipkin, who's at Columbia University, to join us along with his colleagues, the very numerous group here in the Green Lab, to come on board. And these are, Ian Lipkin is the director of the Northeast Biodefense Center and is actively involved in looking at human invertebrate diseases and trying to figure out new pathogens that are popping up worldwide. He in turn brought in the 454 Life Sciences group, including the director of the technology there, to help us with this. So where were we? So back when we were contacted by the beekeepers, as Dennis mentioned before, we were thinking that this was the same old, that we had a varroa problem connected with pathogens. And we have numerous pathogens in bees, as people have talked about. We have the bacteria down here. We have foul brood, both American and European foul brood diseases that can wreak havoc in colonies. In Pennsylvania, if you find American foul brood, the colony either has to be treated effectively or destroyed and burned, the entire equipment destroyed, because this bacteria forms a very temperature-resistant spore. We have numerous viruses that I'll tell you about here that we know that we have in bees. There have been several of these described, as I'll show you here a little bit. We also have the Nosema that you've heard about, Nosema apis and Nosema serrana, with a lot of turmoil and debates situated about what is causing what worldwide in terms of disease. We had the parasites, the varroa mites and the trachea mites that have been introduced to the United States in the late 1980s that have been wreaking havoc and causing tremendous collapse. We also have chalk brood, which goes through the gut as well, that has been a major cause. We have seen increased levels of chalk brood disease or fungal disease in bees. So in my lab, over the last 10 years, we've been looking at primarily the viruses, the varroa mites, and the bees, and so the beekeeper called me up to ask me about this. And so we began to look at these, and one of the things that we found was that we could go into these bees and find all the bee viruses that we had capability of looking for. We could find many or some of the bacteria, but we couldn't blame any of them. We also knew from talking with Jeff and Judy that we couldn't really blame Nosema, that Nosema serrana, as Jeff and Judy have shown, has been here for at least 10 years, maybe even longer. And we don't think that it's linked it well with pathogenesis. So working with Dennis and his group, we began to take apart these bees, as Dennis talked about down there, and we began to find symptoms that were described back in the 1950s, 1930s, that we had never seen before. So if I can get the cursor to work here, that this insect, or the bee gut that's down here, if you look at it, it's in a pyloric valve or cardiac region, for those of you who remember your structure function from way back when. We began to see this melanization pattern, or scarring as we've called it. And the old pathology books in bees describe this as being due to a flagellate, a protozoan, and they gave this genus species name, and if you go and look in the literature, it doesn't exist in Web of Science or in PubMed or any other series. We have no record of what this is, and if you go back and look at the description, it doesn't really give us a clear picture of what it is. We also had descriptions of various kinds of yeast infecting the sting gland and causing some of this melanization, but Again, we don't have any clue what those particular pathogens or what they exist with. We also knew that we could go into these bees and do a PCR reaction, try to look for fungi in general, and we found that most of the bees in certain operations, that is these migratory beekeeping entities, that had detectable fungi. We asked if this was chalk brood, and it wasn't. So that's why I asked my colleague, David Geiser, to come on board. And we began to try to do molecular analysis. In the initial studies of some of the brood that we pulled out, it was looking like we had potentially aspergillus, that we had potentially mucor. And when I started reading and looking at Web Science, some of the species that were popping up are reported in humans as increasing infection levels at significant levels, that these infections are associated with immune-suppressed humans, people that have cancer, transplantation, or aging, or also acquired immunodeficiency. And then in the case of Mucor humealis, that some of the cases we've seen death of human due to this fungus alone. And so Dennis at the top right-hand corner over here kept some of the bees on filter paper, and lo and behold, out popped these fungi that looked very much like mucor. So we had this quandary. We had this very large number of things that we were seeing, but we couldn't blame anything whatsoever. And so we turned over to begin asking about these various hypotheses here, as you've heard about. The top one up here is the one that I tackled, and so the question if we had a new or re-emerging pathogen came to the top. So how do you go look for something that you've never seen before? So Dennis and I happened to make our way down to the National Academy of Science, where there was a talk giving on emerging infectious diseases, and it was both human and agriculture related. And there I got to hear about Ian Lipkin and how he had developed new technologies to look for pathogens. And so it's of reassurance to me as a human being here in the U.S. that he has these technologies, because he's developed ways to look for any known virus and any related viruses of human importance. He has gene chips that have these on there. He has gene chips that have all the bacteria, all the fungi, all the protozoa for vertebrates. And at this meeting, he was talking to a different audience, primarily DOD and NIH. He actually gave a price tag on what it would cost to run these gene chips of $350 a whack. And at the ABF meeting, hopefully I got the initials right here, in Austin of the industry, the National Honey Board was there, and I said, could we potentially get $10,000 to run so many of these analyses of gene chips? And they said, okay, we can do it. So I wrote Ian Lipkin an email, and he didn't toss it out thinking I was a crazy person. He actually responded and came on board, and we have to be very grateful to Ian Lipkin, because the study that I'm about to tell you would never have happened if he hadn't come on board. And he used it as a demonstration of the capabilities of the Biodefense Center. So if you think of bees, they're a very good model system for us as humans. You can think of each colony as being an individual little city or society onto itself, and you can look at diseases across the whole. So what we did was basically went to him, and he also came up with the idea that maybe these vertebrate gene chips weren't the best way, that we needed to take a brand new approach, and that is look at everything that was in these bees, every potential organism that was there. So we did what's called a metagenomic approach. So what we did was we took apart the bee, extracted all the nucleic acid, and then sequenced everything that was there, got rid of the honeybee genes. As Maya talked about, we had luckily had the honeybee genome that just has been completed, that we could subtract those sequences away and leave us with every other organism is there. So we looked at basically plant, viruses, fungi, the plants were the pollen, I have to mention, the bacteria, and everything that was in the bees. We also took the samples that Jeff and Dennis collected, as they talked about, from 10 CCD operations, our historical samples from Penn State. We had healthy bees from Hawaii that don't have varroa mites and that haven't seen the huge pesticide levels that we used as a control. And then we had potential routes of entry into the United States. And this is where we're thinking that if we potentially have a new pathogen, it could have come from outside. As Ian Lipkin has said, viruses know no bounds. that they don't observe international borders. They even can easily move around. So we knew that Australian bees had been imported in 2005, not to point a finger at them, but that was the first legalized importation since 1922, or at least 100 years. And we also had learned that some beekeepers, in order to improve their queen breeding capabilities, were doing what's called wet grafting, that they put a small amount of royal jelly in with the new eggs or larvae into the nurse colonies to get those bees to grow up those larvae into queens. And as you can imagine, going from a cell that has 100 microliters of royal jelly, trying to get large enough amounts to put a teaspoon in each of these cells, it takes a lot of effort and ability. And they found that they had this ready supply of royal jelly being imported in the United States, this fresh royal jelly, as a potential tool. And as Colin Stewart over here will look at me and say, Colin's with APHIS here, that it's not legal, that this royal jelly is not being brought in. It's illegal to use it in this aspect, but it's economically viable here. It saves them a lot of cost. So we knew that they had done this. This is a practice that is also being used in other parts of the world. Yeah, we had learned about that New Zealand, they had banned importation of royal jelly because of fears of getting European foul brood in. So basically, as I said, we took these bees apart. So we had our 10 CCD operations. What we did was to pool them. We took pools of 60 bees from these operations, extracted the RNA out, and used them for this high throughput sequencing. So the 454 company has developed a technology called pyrosequencing that's revolutionized biology as a whole. It allows you to sequence very rapidly and get small pieces of sequence, about 250 base pairs, very easily and relatively cheaply as compared to what we used to do. And so we can theoretically sequence the entire genome of a bacterium in a day now, whereas before it would have taken years or months to do this. We did this, we got candidates for organisms, and then we came back to the pool here and to individual colonies within operations, and we did more traditional methods. We did 16S PCR in sequencing, 18S PCR in sequencing. These are two genes that are highly conserved that are used for traditional phylogenetics. We also did real-time PCR for the different pathogens that we think we had pulled up and did sequencing for those using traditional methods. We also developed assays for several different pathogens I'll tell you about here and threw in additional operations. We also went back and found other historical samples that we had tucked away in our freezers that Nancy Ostergay and I at Penn State had been working with. The collections of bees that have come from Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania, as I'll talk about. So what we did with the 454 sequencing was they added primers to the cDNAs, get the cursor here, and sequenced those, and then they clipped those off and got the pieces of sequence. They trimmed the reads down to get them. We really skipped ahead there. Sorry. Trimmed the reads and clustered them into non-redundant scents. So basically, we took the pieces together and found which ones were homologous, assembled them, and then put them together in contigs. At this point in time, we took all the bee genes out and we took the rest of it and blasted it. We used comparisons back to gene bank looking at known genes and comparisons back looking at protein sequences. Protein sequences are much more conserved. So basically we compared everything. And what we found was that we could place 95% of all the sequences we generated back to a known organism. We have a very small number of singletons that aren't placed and have no homology to known genes from any organism. So what did we find? We found that in the bees, as opposed to what I was thinking, we actually found relatively little there. We didn't find the millions of things. My concern at the beginning was we were going to end up with hundreds of organisms that we were going to have to sort through. Well, we came up with a series of bacteria here. We found about 8 different species, and this is what Nancy Moran's student Vince will be talking about later on, telling you about these. We found a very few number of fungi, and I'll go through these. We found the Microsporidia, the Nosema there. We found a eukaryote, a trypanosome, or conidoplastid. And we also found Varroa. We didn't find any of the exotic parasites that Colin Stewart and APHIS are excited about preventing them from getting in the United States. And we found viruses. All the viruses that we found were known bee viruses with the exception of one, and that was the Israeli acute bee paralysis virus that had been identified in sequence, and you'll hear from Elon Sella. But we hadn't known that it existed because papers hadn't yet come out, and we hadn't yet found it in the United States. So to go through these, we began to look at what was associated. So at the top here in the graph, we have the CCDBs here. The population, Pennsylvania, Florida, California, an operation that moves from Montana to California, one that moves from Washington to California, and we have no known association between these. What we found was that they all had Nosema serrana and Nosema apis. They did have different levels of mites. We didn't find one of the bee viruses that we know little about, the chronic bee paralysis virus. We found sacbrood virus, deformed wing virus, acute bee paralysis virus, black and queen cell virus, Kashmir bee virus, and then over here, Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. If you come down here to the non-CCD, the historical bees, basically the only thing that was not present in these historical bees that was in CCDBs is this Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. Because we had, in our Penn State apiaries, we did have Nosema apis. At that time, we didn't have Nosema serrana. We did have the Hawaiian bees with Nosema serrana and little Nosema apis. And the trypanosome, turns out it was across everything. It was in all the bee populations. And I'll come back to the Australian bees. Well, I'll tell you about them here, too. In the Australian bees, we didn't find that many viruses. We found some sacbrood virus, black and queen cell virus, but we also found the Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. These bees came from packages that we had brought in for research. They've been part of the research, the migratory or the radiation study that Dennis talked about early. And they came directly out of the package without touching U.S. equipment, U.S. soil, and we analyzed them directly. In the imported royal jelly, this is where we actually found the Israeli acute paralysis virus initially. It was found in two of the four batches that we looked at. We also found other bee viruses in this royal jelly, and also Nosema. In terms of the trypanosome here, okay, in terms of the trypanosome, the initial placement with this to Leishmania species that is actually a fairly major human pathogen, Leishmania donovi. So at this point in time, as Dennis will tell you, I became rather concerned on biosafety, and so we were concerned that we had to handle all these samples using BL3 conditions because Leishmania donovi is on the select agent list. And it's also one that you have to use BL3 conditions for. So it was much to my relief when we did further sequencing that it places in with the Leishmania and with the trypanosomes, but is not directly connected to these human pathogens. And in further reading, what I've learned is that almost many different groups of insects have trypanosomes in place. So all the different trypanosomes link into this one group here. It doesn't match the known bumblebee trypanosomes or the species that they have in Europe that are associated with their bees. We don't know what it's doing. We also are thinking it's associated with the gut. In terms of the fungus, the U.S. colonies, we found that they have Mucor humealis at the two top arrows here. Two of the operations had it, not all of them. In the Australian packages, we did find an entomopathogenic fungus that places very closely to fungi that are known to infect aphids. We have no idea what impact it has on bees and how it is associated. In terms of the bacteria, I'll let Vince tell you more about this. We think that we actually have symbionts with the bees, that these same species are found worldwide and have been found in other collections at two different points in history. In terms of the viruses, we basically found the one virus here that is primarily in all the different operations, the CCD operations, and in an Australian package in the Royal Jelly China. This was identified in 2004 by Elon Sella, who will be coming up shortly, and we think it has potential for worldwide distribution. So it's in Australia and China, it's in Israel, we have it here in the United States. We hope that other people in other countries will begin looking to determine if they have this virus as well. In terms of these viruses, these are picornaviruses in bees. We have over 18 different viruses that have been described in bees that belong to this group. Picornaviruses, you have probably heard about before, but not given that name. This includes polio and foot and mouth disease virus. It's a huge superfamily of viruses. It includes plant viruses, vertebrate viruses, and insect viruses. In insects, we have the I. flavus viruses that include things like a flattery disease in silk moths. And in honeybees, we have many different viruses that fit in this. Deformed wing virus, Sacbrood virus, Varroa destructor virus, Cucuca virus, and slow bee paralysis virus. And we have another group down below here called the Dicistra viruses. It's basically where we've taken the virus and switched it around into different parts. Here we have the known bee viruses, the cashmere bee virus, black and queen seal virus, and acute bee paralysis virus, Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. These viruses are very simple. They don't have anything in there that we know is involved in immunosuppression or other effects on the bees, but we haven't yet looked at those closely enough. In our lab, we know that they can infect the hemocytes of the bees and may have an impact on immune function at some point. We have shown, and others have shown as well, that when the bee is parasitized by varroa and knocked out the immune system, that these bee viruses amplify in the colony, increase in prevalence and titer within the bees. So we began to look at these viruses and look at sequences, and what we looked at in the Dicistra viruses is here's this one little piece that is shown in red here that's between the two different polyproteins. And this is called the intergenic region. And so we sequenced bees that came out of these different colonies, out of individual operations. And so shown on here is a phylogenetic tree showing at the top acute bee paralysis virus, in the middle cashmere bee virus, at the bottom Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. And what we found was that the bees that we had in the United States, the Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, was very distinct from cashmere bee virus. And if you look at the cashmere bee virus here, we see that we have very similar viruses within these different colonies that came from primarily one operation. And if we look at within different colonies, that's what these numbers are over here, we have very low variation. Interestingly, when we look down here at Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, we find that we have much more sequence diversity and that there's variation within each of the colonies, suggesting that there might be multiple strains there. We also found that the Australian bees and their viruses lump right in with our American bees here using this. And we also found the Israeli sample here. And so we suggested that Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, when we went through all these sequences, that it was highly associated with CCD, that we look at 96.1% of the colonies and could predict that it was associated, that it had a 96.1 predictive value of CCD as opposed to these other three pathogens here. That if we have all four pathogens present in the colony, we can predict 100% that that colony will have CCD. So, what we wanted to know is if IPV was found in other countries, is associated with loss, how long it's been in the United States, how many different strains do we have of IAPV in the U.S. and worldwide? And then lastly, is IAPV just a really good marker for CCD, or is it the actual potential cause? And that's where we're at right now. And if you're interested, I can tell you more about what we're doing on this, that both Jeff Pettis and myself, we're initiating studies to begin to address this last part here. And funding sources, we need to give major credit to the NIH awards to Ian Lipkin for the Northeast Biodefense, National Honey Board, Pennsylvania Chart Ag, and USDA through Jeff, and then we've begun pathogenicity studies here. And then lastly, I'd like to announce that that part of the public attention here has allowed out of the blue Haagen-Dazs to step forward and has made major gifts to both UC Davis and Penn State towards sustainable pollination. And so they're funding us at the both institutions to do things in research, outreach, and in training to help with this. And in February, you'll begin to see this little logo here show up on their ice cream, along with message about what importance bees play in American agriculture. So all their products that have fruit and that's directly dependent on bee pollination will have this symbol on there. And part of that money from the products will come back to support their gifts to Penn State and UC Davis. Part of the gift to Penn State will go towards web-based delivery of the information that we're generating from the entire Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group. And hopefully we hope that this attention will benefit entomology as a whole and not just the two institutions here. And unfortunately, the convention center or whoever wanted a lot of money, otherwise Haagen-Dazs would have treated us to their new flavor vanilla honeybee that will be showing up at today's symposium. So with that, I'd like to thank you for coming, and we'll have a break here, and we'll come back and we'll start the last part. 10-minute break here. Thanks.